Thus anyone who is able to pay attention, to think steadily on one subject for a little time without letting the mind wander, is ready to begin meditation. We may define meditation as the sustained attention of the concentrated mind in face of an object of devotion, of a problem that needs illumination to be intelligible, of anything, in fact, whereof the life is to be realized and absorbed, rather than the form. It is the art of considering a subject or turning it over in the mind in its various bearings and relationships. Another definition of meditation is that it consists of the endeavor to bring into the waking consciousness, that is, into the mind in its normal state of activity, some realization of the superconsciousness, to create by the power of aspiration a channel through which the influence of the divine or spiritual principle, the real man, may irradiate the lower personality. It is the reaching out of the mind and feelings towards an ideal, and the opening of the doors of the imprisoned lower consciousness to the influence of the ideal. Meditation, said H. P. Blavatsky, is the inexpressible longing of the inner man for the infinite. St. Alphonsus de Liguori spoke of meditation as the blessed furnace in which souls are inflamed with divine love. The ideal chosen may be abstract, such as a virtue, it may be the divinity in man, it may be personified as a master of divine teacher. But in all cases it is essentially an uplifting of the soul towards its divine source, the desire of the individual self to become one with the universal self. What food is to the physical life, so is meditation to the spiritual life. The man of meditation is ever the most effective man of the world. Lord Rosebery, speaking of Cromwell, described him as a practical mystic, and declared that a practical mystic is the greatest force in the world. The concentrated intellect, the power of withdrawing outside the turmoil, means immensely increased energy in work, more steadiness, self-control, serenity. The man of meditation is the man who wastes not time, scatters no energy, misses no opportunity. Such a man governs events, because within him is the power whereof events are only the outer expression. He shares the divine life, and therefore shares the divine power. As was said before, when the mind is kept shaped to one image, and the knower steadily contemplates it, he obtains a far fuller knowledge of the object than he could obtain by means of any verbal description of it. As concentration is performed, the picture is shaped in the mental body, and concentration on rough outline, derived from, say, a verbal description, fills in more and more detail, as the consciousness comes more closely in touch with the things described. All religions recommend meditation, and its desirability has been recognized by every school of philosophy. Just as a man who wishes to be strong uses prescribed exercises to develop his muscles, so the student of occultism uses definite and prescribed exercises to develop his astral and mental bodies. There are, of course, many kinds of meditation. Just as there are many types of men, it is clearly not possible that one method of meditation which is most suited to him. Meditation has many objects, of which the principal ones are as follows. 1. It ensures that at least once a day a man shall think of high and holy things, his thoughts being taken away from the petty round of daily life, from its frivolities and its troubles. 2. It accustoms the man to think of such matter, so that after a time they form a background to his daily life, to which his mind returns with pleasure when it is released from the immediate demands of his business. 3. It serves as a kind of astral and mental gymnastics, to preserve these higher bodies in health and to keep the stream of divine life flowing through them. For these purposes it should be remembered that the regularity of the exercises is of the first importance. 4. It may be used to develop character, to build into it various qualities and virtues. 5. It raises the consciousness to higher levels, so as to include the higher and subtler things. Through it a man may rise to the presence of the divine. 6. It opens the nature and calls down blessings from higher planes. 7. It is the way, even though it be only the first halting step upon the way, which leads to higher development and wider knowledge, to the attainment of clairvoyance, and eventually to the higher life beyond this physical world altogether. Meditation is the readiest and safest method of developing the higher consciousness. It is unquestionably possible for any man in process of time, by meditation, say, upon the Logos or the Master, to raise himself first to the astral and then to mental levels, but of course, none can say how long it will take, as that depends entirely upon the past of the student and the efforts he makes. A man occupied in the earnest study of higher things is for the time lifted entirely out of himself, and generates a powerful though form in the mental world, which is immediately employed as a channel by the force hovering in the world nest above. When a body of men join together in thought of this nature, the channel which they make is out of all proportion larger in its capacity than the sum of their separate channels. Such a body of men is, therefore, an inestimable blessing to the community amidst which it works. In their intellectual studies they may be the cause of an outpouring into the lower mental world of force which is normally peculiar to the higher mental. If their thought deals with ethics and soul development in its higher aspects, they may make a channel of more elevated thought through which the force of the Buddhic world may descend into the mental. They are thus able to cause influence to be radiated out upon many a person who would not be in the least open to the action of that force if it had remained on its original level. This, in fact, is the real and greatest function of, for example, a lodge of the Theosophical Society to furnish a channel for the distribution of the divine life. For every lodge of the Theosophical Society is a center of interest to the masters of the wisdom and their pupils. Consequently, the thoughts of the members of the lodge, when engaged in study, discussion, etc., may attract the attention of the masters, a force being then poured out far more exalted than anything deriving from the members themselves. Members of the Theosophical Society may be reminded that it has been stated by Dr. Besant that a master has said that when a person joins the society, he is connected with them by a tiny thread of life. This thread is the line of magnetic rapport with the master, and the student may by arduous effort, by devotion and unselfish service, strengthen and enlarge the thread until it becomes a line of living light. It is possible to call down a blessing from a still higher source. The life and light of the deity flood the whole of his system, the force at each level or plane being normally strictly limited to it. If, however, a special channel be prepared for it, it can descend to, and illuminate a lower level. Such a channel is always provided whenever any thought or feeling has an entirely unselfish aspect. Selfish feeling moves in a closed curve, and so brings its own response on its own level. An utterly unselfish emotion is an outrush of energy which does not return, but in its upward movement provides a channel for a downpouring of divine power from the level next above. This is the reality lying at the back of an idea of the answer to prayer. To a clairvoyant, this channel is visible as a great vortex, a kind of gigantic cylinder or funnel. This is the nearest explanation that can be given in the physical world, but it is inadequate, because as the force flows down through the channel, it somehow makes itself one with the vortex, and issues from it colored by it and bearing with it distinctive characteristics which show through what channel it has come. By meditation, a man's astral and mental bodies gradually come out of chaos into order, slowly expand and gradually learn to respond to higher and higher vibrations. Each effort helps to thin the veil that divides him from the higher world and direct knowledge. His thought forms grow day by day more definite, so that the life poured into them from above becomes fuller and fuller. Meditation thus helps to build into the bodies the higher types of matter. It often leads to lofty emotions being experienced, these coming from the buddhic level and being reflected in the astral body. In addition, there is needed also development of the mental and causal bodies, in order to give steadiness and balance. Otherwise, fine emotions which sway the man in the right direction may very readily become a little twisted and sway him along other and less desirable lines. With feeling alone, perfect balance or steadiness can never be obtained. The directing power of mind and will is needed as well as the motive force of emotion. In practicing meditation, the student may find useful a knowledge of the five stages of mind as expounded by Patanjali. He should recollect, however, that these stages are not confined to the mental plane, but exist, in appropriate form, on every plane. They are: 1. Kshpta, the butterfly mind, which darts constantly from one object to another. It corresponds to activity on the physical plane. 2. Mudda, The confused stage in which the man is swayed and bewildered by emotions, it corresponds to activity in the astral world. 3. Vikshipta. The state of preoccupation of infatuation by an idea, the man is possessed, we might say obsessed, by an idea. This corresponds to activity in the lower mental world. The man should learn Vivka, cp. 294, which has to do with the cognitional aspect of consciousness. 4. Ekagrata, one-pointedness. The state of possessing an idea, instead of being possessed by it. This corresponds to activity on the higher mental plane. The man should here learn Vairagya, cp. 295, which has to do with the activity aspect of consciousness. 5. Nirada, self-control, rising above all ideas, the man chooses as he wills according to his illumined will. This corresponds to activity on the Buddhic plane. The man should here learn Shatsampatti, cp. 294, which has to do with the will aspect of consciousness. When complete control has been acquired, so that the man can inhibit all motions of the mind, then he is ready for samadhi, corresponding to contemplation, with which we shall deal more fully in our next chapter. Meanwhile, for the sake of completeness, it is desirable to give here a preliminary idea of samadhi. Etymologically, samadhi means fully placing together, and may therefore be rendered into English as composing the mind, that is, collecting it all together, checking all distractions. Yoga, says Vyasa, is the composed mind. This is the original meaning of samadhi, though it is more often used to denote the trance state, which is the natural result of perfect composure. Samadhi is of two kinds. 1. Samprajnata samadhi, that is, samadhi with consciousness turned outwards towards objects. 2. Asamprajnata samadhi, that is, samadhi without consciousness, with consciousness turned inwards, withdrawn into itself so that it passes into the next higher vehicle. For convenience of reference, these facts are set out in tabular form on page 146. The student may also like to have a brief enumeration of the four states of mind spoken of in yoga. They are, 1. Jagrat, waking consciousness, 2. Svapna, dream consciousness, consciousness working in the astral body and able to impress its experiences upon the brain. 3. Sushupti, deep sleep consciousness, working in the mental body, and not able to impress its experiences on the physical brain. 4. Triya, trance consciousness, so far separated from the brain that it cannot readily be recalled by outer means. No. Stages of mind quality to be acquired aspect of Sanskrit English consciousness 1 Kshipta butterfly mindedness dash. 2 Mudda confusion 3 Vikshipta infatuation Vivka, discrimination, cognition 4 Ekagrata one-pointedness Vairagya, dispassion, activity 5 Niruddha self-control Shatsampatti, 6-fold mental qualifications, or 6 samadhi composure of mind, leading to trance dash. It is important to note, however, that these four states of consciousness exist on every plane. The following gives examples of the four states in physical consciousness, and is arranged in tabular form for the sake of compactness and clarity. The four states of consciousness Sanskrit English examples in physical consciousness Jagrat waking to read a book to look at a watch Svapna dream to perceive the meaning of the words to imagine the watch Sushupti deep sleep to touch the mind of the writer to conceive the ideal watch earlier trance to enter the mind of the writer to pass to the idea of time in the abstract. It should also be noted that the terms are relative, thus, for most people, Jagrat, or waking consciousness, is that part of the total consciousness which is functioning in the brain and nervous system, and which is definitely self-conscious. We may think of consciousness as a great egg of light, of which one end only is inserted into the brain, that end is the waking consciousness. But, as self-consciousness is developed in the astral world, and the brain develops sufficiently to answer to its vibrations, astral consciousness becomes a part of the waking consciousness. The mental consciousness would then be the svapna, or dream consciousness. Similarly, when mental self-consciousness is developed, and the brain answers to it, the waking consciousness includes the mental, and so on, until all the consciousness on the five planes is included in the waking consciousness. This enlarging of waking consciousness involves development in the atoms of the brain as well as the development of certain organs in the brain, and of the connections between the cells. For the inclusion of astral self-consciousness, the pituitary body must be developed, and the fourth set of spirally in the atoms must be perfected. For the inclusion of mental self-consciousness, the pineal gland must be active, and the fifth set of spirally in thorough working order. If these physical developments are not achieved, then the astral and mental consciousness remain superconsciousness, and are not expressed through the brain. Again, if a man possesses no physical body, then his Jagrat or waking consciousness is his astral consciousness. Thus, a wider definition of Jagrat would be that it is that part of the total consciousness which is working through its outermost vehicle. We may also reconsider, from the point of view of the above analysis, Samadhi. Samadhi is a state of consciousness in which the body is insensible, but the mind is fully self-conscious, and from which the mind returns to the physical brain with the memory of its superphysical experiences. If a man throws himself into a trance, and is active on the astral plane, then his Samadhi is on the astral. If he functions on the mental plane, then his Samadhi is on that plane. The man who can practice Samadhi can thus withdraw from the physical body so as to leave it insensitive while his mind is fully conscious. Samadhi is therefore a relative term. Thus a master begins his Samadhi on the plane of Atma, and rises thence to the higher cosmic planes. The word Samadhi is also sometimes used to denote the condition just beyond the level where a man can retain consciousness. Thus, for a savage whose consciousness is clear only on the physical plane, the astral plane would be Samadhi. It means that when the man comes back to his lower vehicles, he would bring with him no definite additional knowledge and no new power of doing anything of use. This kind of Samadhi is not encouraged in the highest schools of occultism. Going to sleep and going into Samadhi are largely the same process, but while one is due to ordinary conditions and has no significance, the other is due to the action of the trained will and is a priceless power. Physical means of inducing trance, such as hypnotism, drugs, staring at a black spot on a white ground, or at the point of the nose, and other similar practices, belong to the method of the yoga, and are never employed in Raja Yoga. To a clairvoyant, the difference between a mesmerized subject and the self-induced trance of a yogi is at once apparent. In the mesmerized or hypnotized subject, all the principles are present, the higher manas paralyzed, body severed from it through that paralysis, and the astral body entirely subjected to lower manas and karma. In the yogi, on the other hand, the principles of the lower quaternary disappear entirely, except for hardly perceptible vibrations of the golden-hued prana and a violet flame streaked with gold rushing upwards from the head and culminating in a point. The mesmerized or hypnotized person recollects in his brain nothing of his experiences, the yogi remembers everything that has happened to him. A few practical examples will perhaps best illustrate some of the methods employed in meditation. The student will do well to commence by cultivating the thought, until it becomes habitual, that the physical body is an instrument of the spirit. He should think of the physical body, how it is possible to control and direct it, and then should separate himself in thought from it, repudiate it, in fact. Next, perceiving that he can control his emotions and desires, he should repudiate the astral body, with its desires and emotions, then, picturing himself as in the mental body, and again reflecting that he can control and direct his thoughts, he should repudiate his mind, and should then let himself soar into the free atmosphere of the spirit where is eternal peace, resting there for a moment. Let him strive with great intensity to realize that that is the real self. Descending again in consciousness, he should endeavor to carry with him the peace of the spirit into his different bodies. Another exercise would be to direct the meditation to character building, selecting for the purpose of virtue, let us say harmlessness. The attention having been concentrated, the subject is thought about in its many aspect, egg, harmlessness is act, in speech, in thought, in desire, how harmlessness would be expressed in the life of the ideal man, how it would affect his daily life, how he would treat people if he had fully acquired the virtue, and so forth. Having thus meditated upon harmlessness, he would carry with him into the daily life a state of mind that would soon express itself in all his action and thoughts. Other qualities could, of course, be similarly treated. A few months of earnest effort along these lines would produce wonderful changes in a man's life, as described in the memorable words of Plotinus. Withdraw into yourself and look. And if you do not find yourself beautiful as yet, do as does the creator of a statue that is to be made beautiful. He cuts away here, he smooths there. He makes the line lighter, this other purer, until he has shown a beautiful face upon the statue. So do you also, cut away all that is excessive, straighten all that is crooked, bring light to all that is shadowed, labor to make all glow with beauty, and do not cease chiseling your statue until there shall shine out on you the godlike splendor of virtue, until you shall see the final goodness surely established in the stainless shrine. Plotinus on the Beautiful, translated by Stephen McKenna. Meditation upon a virtue thus causes a man gradually to grow into the possession of that virtue, as finely said in the Hindu scriptures, what a man thinks on, that he becomes, therefore think on the eternal. And again, man is the creation of thought. An excellent example of what may be done in this manner by meditation is that of a certain man who for 40 years meditated daily upon truth. The effect was that he so tuned himself to the mode of truth that he always knew when a man was lying by the jar that he felt in himself. It so happened that the man was a judge, so that his faculty must have stood him in good stead. In this work a man is employing his imagination, the great tool used in yoga. If a man imagines in his thought that he has a certain quality, he is halfway to possessing that quality. If he imagines himself free from a certain failing, he is halfway to being free from that failing. So powerful a weapon is a trained imagination that a man may by its use rid himself of half his troubles and his faults. It is not wise to brood over faults, as it tends to encourage morbidness and depression, which act as a wall, shutting out spiritual influences. In practice, it is better to ignore faults of disposition so far as may be done, and to concentrate on building the opposite virtues. Success in the spiritual life is gained less by fierce wrestling with the lower nature than by growing into the knowledge and appreciation of higher things. For once we have sufficiently experienced the bliss and joyousness of the higher life, by contrast the lower desires pale and lose their attractiveness. It was said by a great teacher that the best form of repentance for a transgression was to look ahead with hopeful courage, coupled with the firm resolve not to commit the transgression again. Next, suppose the purpose of the meditation is to be intellectual understanding of an object, and the relation of it to other objects. It is important for the student to recollect that the first work of the knower is to observe, accurately, for on the accuracy of the observation depends the thought. If the observation is inaccurate, then out of that initial error will spring a number of consequent errors that nothing can put right save going back to the very beginning. The object having thus been carefully observed, the stream of thought is played upon it so as to grasp it in all its natural, superphysical and metaphysical aspects, an effort being made to make quite clear and definite that level of the consciousness which is still nebula. Let the subject be, for example, harmony. Consider it in relation to the various senses, consider it in music, in color, in phenomena of many different kinds, seek to discover the principal features of harmony, and how it differs from other similar and contrasting ideas, what part it plays in the succession of events, what is its use, what results from its absence. Having answered all these, and many other questions, an endeavor should be made to drop all concrete images or thoughts, and to hold in thought the abstract idea of harmony. The student must bear in mind that mental sight is quite as real and satisfying as is physical sight. Thus it is possible to train the mind to see, say, the idea of harmony, or the square root of 2, as clearly and as certainly as one sees a tree or a table with physical vision. For our third example, let us take a devotional meditation. Think of the ideal man, the master, or, if preferred, the deity, or any manifestation of the deity. Allow the thought to play upon the subject from different aspects, so that it constantly awakens admiration, gratitude, reverence, worship. ponder upon all the qualities manifested in the subject and take each quality in all its aspects and relationships. From a general standpoint, an abstract ideal and a personality are equally good for purposes of meditation. A person of intellectual temperament will usually find the abstract ideal the more satisfactory. One of the emotional temperament will demand a concrete embodiment of his thought. The disadvantage of the abstract ideal is that it is apt to fail in compelling aspiration. The disadvantage of the concrete embodiment is that the embodiment is apt to fall below the ideal. We may here take a special notice of the result of meditating on the Master. This makes a definite link with the Master, which shows itself to the clairvoyant vision as a kind of line of light. The Master always subconsciously feels the impinging of such a line and sends out along it in response a steady stream of magnetism which continues to play long after the meditation is over. If a picture is used for purposes of meditation, it may often be observed to change in expression. This is because the will can be trained to act directly upon physical matter, the actual physical particles being unquestionably affected by the power of strong sustained thought. One other form of meditation may be given, viz., that of mantric meditation. A mantram is a definite succession of sounds arranged by an occultist in order to bring about certain definite results. Those sounds, repeated rhythmically over and over again in succession, synchronize the vibrations of the vehicles into unity with themselves. A mantram is thus a mechanical way of checking vibrations, or inducing the vibrations that are desired. Its efficacy depends upon what is known as sympathetic vibration, vide the astral body, pages 157-8. The more a mantram is repeated, the more powerful the result. Hence the value of repetition in church formulae, and of the rosary, which enables the consciousness to be fully concentrated on what is being said and thought, undistracted by the task of keeping count. In this method of meditation, practiced largely in India, the devotee directs his mind, say, to Sri Krishna, the incarnate God, the spirit of love and knowledge in the world. A sentence is taken and chanted over and over again as a mantram, while its deep and varied meaning is intently pondered upon. Thus the devotee brings himself in touch with the great Lord himself. The above constitutes the briefest outline of certain forms of meditation. For further description and detail, the student is referred to that excellent manual Concentration by Ernest Wood, to Meditation for Beginners by J.I. Wedgwood, and to the admirable chapters on Thought Control and on Building of Character in the Outer Court, by Dr. Besant. An excellent ego meditation is given in Gods in Exile, by J.J. Van der Lee, LL.D., in the afterword at the end of that admirable little book. Many people meditate daily alone, with success, but there are even greater possibilities when a group of people concentrate their minds on the one thing. That sets up a strain in the physical ether as well as in the astral and mental worlds, and it is a twist in the direction which we desire. Thus, instead of having to fight against our surroundings, as is usually the case, we find them actually helpful, provided of course, that all present succeed in holding their minds from wandering. A wandering mind in such a group constitutes a break in the current, so that instead of there being a huge mass of thought moving in one mighty flood, there would be eddies in it, like rocks which deflect the water in a river. A striking example of the tremendous power of collective meditation and thought was that of the Diamond Jubilee of Queen Victoria. C.W. Leadbeater describes that occasion as one of the most wonderful manifestations of occult force that he ever saw. The crowd became so exalted that people were lifted right out of themselves by their emotions, thus experiencing a tremendous uplift of soul. A similar effect, on a small scale, can be produced by group meditation. We will now consider the physical adjuncts of meditation. In meditation, posture is not unimportant. The body should be put into a comfortable position, and then forgotten. If it is uncomfortable, it cannot be forgotten, as it would constantly call attention to itself. Furthermore, just as certain thoughts and emotions tend to express themselves in characteristic movements and gestures of the body, so, by a reversal of the process, positions of the body may tend to induce states of mind and feeling, and so assist the student in dwelling on them. The majority of Western people will find it most comfortable to sit in an armchair, the back of which does not slope unduly. The hands may be clasped and rest on the legs, or be laid lightly on the knees. The feet may be placed together or crossed with the right over the left.